Okay, folks, we'll get going. What is our most valuable resource and also our biggest enemy? Oh, you're so astute. Time. Yes, it is our most valuable resource, it could be, and it is one of our greatest enemies as humans. It's slow in hard times and fast in good times. Slow in extra time when you're winning 1-0. Fast in extra time when you're losing 1-0. And those sports people, football fans amongst you, you'll know what I'm talking about. James is going to come now and read Ecclesiastes 3, which we've already touched on this morning, but this is a slightly different version from the Jewish Anecdote Bible. So James, over to you.
So Ecclesiastes 3. A season is set for everything, a time for every experience under heaven, a time for being born and a time for dying, a time for planting and a time for uprooting the planted, a time for slaying and a time for healing, a time for tearing down and a time for building up, a time for weeping and a time for laughing, a time for wailing and a time for dancing, a time for throwing stones and a time for gathering stones, a time for embracing and a time for shunning embraces, a time for seeking and a time for losing, a time for keeping and a time for discarding, a time for ripping and a time for sowing, a time for silence and a time for speaking, a time for loving and a time for hating, a time for war and a time for peace.
Okay, so Mark's already referred to this song. So this is a song written by a guy called Pete Seeger in 1959. It was performed by a US folk band called The Birds. And this is them performing this song called Turn, Turn, Turn. And we'll just listen and watch some of it because it's very bizarre. Well. Now, we could watch that for 3 minutes, but you get the gist, don't you? So that, those lyrics for that song are 2,000 years old, apart from the turn, turn, turn bit, which you'll notice is not actually in Ecclesiastes 3. And they were performing that song as a protest against the Vietnam War. And part of their protest was to say, it's a time for peace and not a time for war. So turn, turn, turn towards peace. And of course, it raises the question how we use Ecclesiastes 3 to understand what we do with the material, this poem that the guy called Coelette, who's the teacher, he's a preacher, he's a sage, he's a wise royal ruler and king. And we're trying to find out from him, what does time mean? And what are we supposed to do in that time, in these seasons, as already Mark has led us to think about? Now, we're reading a book on Wednesday called How to Inhabit Time by a guy called James K.A. Smith. And he refers to a neurological condition called dyschronometria. Does anybody know what dyschronometria is? Something to do with time, because it's got the word chron in it, yes. So it's a neurological condition where people lose the ability to accurately estimate the passage of time. Now, if you're an impatient person or a person that doesn't like lateness, for me, you may presume that most people that are late or perpetually late have got dyschronometria. A lot of what James K.A. Smith says is that Christianity, in particular modern Christianity, suffers from spiritual dyschronometria. In a sense, they lack, or we lack, the awareness of what time we are in and what time it is. And of course, we may have heard in all the sermons and all the teaching that we have heard over the years, I've heard all sorts of things about the nature of time, quoted from this particular poem and passage by Coelette in Ecclesiastes 3. And it has spawned a poor theology of time. You may have heard things like God's timeless principles in the Bible, or we trust in God's timing, or God is never late, but he's always on time. And you think to yourself, what on earth does this all mean? Now, what I'm going to explore today, and then as the second part next week, is not a conclusive theology of time. Space doesn't, or time, permit us to do that. But we're looking at really what Ecclesiastes 3 says in relation to time. And how particularly Coelette, this sage, asks us the question, how do we inhabit time? And then a look alongside that to see what James K.A. Smith says in terms of asking the question, when are we? When are we? Because it's his claim that we don't know who we are until we know when we are. Our past, our present, our future. Now, this is the opposite of any time management advice that Christians or anybody else may give you. Is trying to understand both the spiritual and the practical significance of timekeeping, our temporal, seasonal, mortal existence, because that is an emphasis that Coelette puts on. So if we're going to consider for a moment the archaeological strata of our lives, our souls, our bodies, our personhood, we are, in all of us, in all of our beings, our minds, our emotions, the totality of us, we are formed by a process forged in time. We are multiple layers of time. For example, Jimmy is the Jurassic period. What? Aren't you? 150 million years forged in time. I may be the Cretaceous period, which is like 66 million years ago. And there are other people that were less forged in time. Emin, for example, is only 4 weeks old, 4 weeks old, and yet actually his time goes back longer than that. Consider our lives as an archaeological dig. We are layered and we are formed by a process, a strata of different things that impact us and shape us who we are. James K.A. Smith says, we wear time. And that's a great phrase to describe actually what happens to us. We talk about muscle memory. If you haven't got on a bike for a while, sometimes if you've learned to ride a bike, muscle memory kicks in because you just know how to do it. You don't have to walk through all the thing, well, what to do, what to do. Very often you just get on because your body kicks in. It has a memory of riding a bike, muscle memory. We talk about the body keeping a score. How wounds and trauma is held within our bodies. And so we literally wear time. And so we are both actors in time, we are agents of time, but time is actually done to us as well. We suffer time, we experience time. So we change time, we act in time, we are agents of time, but time is done to us. We are vulnerable to time, every moment, and our aging bodies and minds. And Coëlette speaks of 14 poetic couplets. And Mark has helpfully put them on here, which is good. In this particular version, which I think is the New International Version, if you want to turn to it, has someone got... Tricia, what's the page number on... 671. So if you want to turn to it on your Bible, so you've got it in front of you, because I will be referencing other verses as well beyond these verses here. So these are 14 poetic couplets, and they are polarities of seasons. Seasons of the human drama. 28 seasons in total. So if you think about this as an archaeological dig, there are 28 seasons of everything under the sun. This thing that Coëlette is doing, and the author of these words, is a literary device called merism. Does anybody know what merism is? M-E-R-I-S-N-M. Merism is a literary device where two opposites are used to contrast each other and everything in between. So, for example, you will know a merism when I say it. Jesus is the first and the... Last, yes. And the Bible authors are saying he's everything in between. He's the Alpha and the Omega and everything in between. So the polarities, the opposite, is saying here is birth and here is death and here is life in between. Here is war, here is peace and everything in between. Weeping and laughing, everything in between. Seeking and losing, killing and healing, tearing and mending. Life is a rich tapestry of contrasting colours, black and white, and everything in between. The bold colours, the bright colours, and the pastel colours, and everything in between. That's how he's using it. And it speaks, therefore, of a life personally, socially, tribally, internationally, of the rhythms and the oscillations of life that cover the whole of life in these 28 seasons. But we've got to get a few things right, and this is what we're going to look at this morning in particular, in order to read these 28 seasons correctly. First of all, we've got to say that these seasons, these poetic couplets and seasons, they are a description of life, not a prescription of what to do in life. You see, the birds used it as a way to say, this is what we need to do. We need to turn from a time of war into a time of peace. It makes a lovely melody in the 1960s, but actually it is not a correct reading of Ecclesiastes 3, because Coëlette is not telling us what to do. He's just stating what is. He's not telling us to turn to birth and turn to death. He's not telling us to turn to healing or from wounding. He's not telling us to turn from throwing stones and gathering stones. He's just saying, this is life. This is what happens. And he's not, therefore, expressing a preference for either action or behaviour. He doesn't desire one thing or another, even though we do, of course. Call me traditional, but I most prefer healing than I do with killing. I prefer laughing than weeping, although sometimes if you laugh so hard, you do the same thing at the same time in terms of weeping. I much prefer love than hate. So, of course, these are preferences and desires that we can pick out of these polarities. But Coëlette is not preferring any of them. He's just saying this is the whole gambit of life. These 28 seasons, there is not much that you can't state is life, because everything in between happens as well. And so we may have perhaps in the teaching of schemes of things across the years heard Christians or church leaders or teachers say we're entering a time of something, a time to tear down. We're trying to to build, a time to plant, much in the same way as that, you know, if Lorna were going out, Lorna and I are going out for the day, and we come back inside and said, I think it's time for a cup of tea. Colette is not saying it's a time for a cup of tea, that we must do it. And, you know, we can use these times and seasons to say we must do something. And I know, of course, it has been used to ignite war by saying there is a time for war and a time for peace, and this is a time for war, if war is on your agenda, of course. But Colette is not using it that way, or not stating that way, and we should not use it then as a way to justify a season of doing something. He's not saying this is a script which we must follow, but merely the description of the vast array of life, the varied ebb and flow. Some things are destructive, some things are constructive, but it's what we inhabit. This is the whole gambit of life. So we can say quite confidently, there is never a time to kill or to hate. And that won't go against what he's saying. We can say confidently, there is not a time to hate or a time for war. Of course, if you are a warmonger, then you may disagree with me. But what he's saying here, under the scheme of life, under the sun, there is a time when all these things happen. Now, some of them may be destructive, some of them may be constructive, but there are whole nuances there which we may understand happen at any stage of our lives. So we may have war and peace, we may have being born and dying, and we may choose one of those things, but there are also polarities like silence and speaking that we have to determine when is the wise time to do that. We don't choose one another as good or bad, because we know that there is a time, literally, to speak and a time to be silent. There is a time to plant and a time to uproot. We're not talking about something that is favourable and unfavourable. We're talking about things that just happen at an appropriate time. There's a time to keep and there is a time to discard. If you were Lorna, she would say there's always a time to declutter and discard, of course. And not to keep as much and not to buy stuff, because it's a time to discard and get rid of stuff. So we're not talking about necessarily the good and the bad to choose. Some things just happen. But some of those are unfavourable and favourable things. And some of them are just neutral things that we choose a time to do those things. There is another verse which I want to draw your attention to further down. In verse 9 to 11, Colette says this: what do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. Another version says, he brings everything to pass precisely in its time, or at its time. Now, this is a difficult verse. It has been a misunderstood verse, and it has been a weaponized verse. This verse describes order, not ordination. Order, but not ordination. Get this straight. God doesn't ordain or dictate the precise moment of time where individuals or societies or churches or countries experience these different seasons. We can't say it is a time for planting, it's a time for uprooting, it's a time for war and it's time for peace. And God has somehow orchestrated and ordained those things to happen at that certain moment in time. So if you're going through a particular season, it isn't that God has done that season to you, either as a reward or a punishment. It is not a measure of your success or your failure. It is just what it is. God works in the world, inhabits time, but he doesn't ordain moments where we are prescribed to do something. So, he doesn't ordain a moment of dancing or crying or gathering or loving or birthing or healing or seeking. All of these things fit in the vast beauty and the brutality of God's creation and time, which God loves, has made, and inhabits. Coelette is saying, this is order and it is not random chaos. That is his whole point. All these times, all these 28 seasons, there is order and equilibrium to what is going on, and life is just not a random chaotic mess. So when we read, he has made everything beautiful in its time, it's not a reason to turn round to someone that's going through a mourning process or going through some tragedy and say, well, God is going to bring everything beautiful in its time, don't worry. Well, I hope you get punched in the head. It's the time for punching you if you come up with that kind of pastoral advice. Because God has not ordained that time in order to make it beautiful when it happens. As if God has micromanaged the world in that way and the time these things happen. That is a terrible theology of both God's power and God's time. So God's timing is perfect is really a destructive comment. Also saying, obviously, God is in control is another one, which is obviously a pet peeve of mine. So I famously avoid using the C word when it comes to describing God's power in the world and God's time of power in the world. But that's another issue. What Coelette is saying in conclusion to this particular part is to say, these seasons are the neither prescribed things for us to do or described action that God does. He's therefore saying there is a beauty, a beautiful orderliness about creation and about life. There are boundaries which provide equilibrium and not chaos. And we therefore, as Coelette goes on to say, gifted the boundaries of time and for us to lean into our creaturehood, the limitations of time and the boundaries of time that we find ourselves in, these particular 28 seasons. And then he goes on to say, in verse 11, he puts eternity in their minds, yet we cannot fathom what God has done from beginning until end. Coelette here is making a distinction between animal life and human life. And under the surface, I think it may go something like this. We are not eternal creatures. This is not a reference to the theology of us being eternal creatures just because God has put eternity in our minds. What he's saying is here, we are unique on this earth. Dogs do not sit under a tree and meditate on the meaning of life. Now, they may go under a tree for a different reason, to go for a pee, but they don't meditate on the meaning of life. We do that. We do that in all sorts of times and places. The human unique position and condition is our ability to yearn for something more than what we see. We recognise there is something beyond us, something transcendent, something eternal, and the animal kingdom, as far as we know, and we may get a surprise some down the line, don't do this thinking on the mystery of transcendence, what is beyond us, what is eternal and to come. Someone said in this particular verse, in a different phrase, God has put permanence in our minds. God has put permanence in our minds, but temporalness in our bodies. And again, we have to cope with that. We have to cope with the massive chasm and void between having a consciousness There is more to life, and yet there are limitations to our bodies and our minds. All of us do that every day. And believe me, as you get old, it even gets worse than that. Age has the habit of trying to reconcile this difference between what we think about more in life beyond us and the limitations and mortal bodies that we inhabit, the frailty of our bodies. God has made us, someone said, cosmic misfits. In a sense that there is this restless yearning for something beyond us, but a physical and sometimes emotional and spiritual inability to comprehend what it is. Now, of course, Christianity would say we have access, we have a gateway, we have a glimpse into that yearning and have a fulfillment in part of that yearning because we've had an experience of God through Jesus. And that is totally correct. But at this stage, Qohelet knows nothing about Jesus. And yet we can understand part of the human condition as we see all around us is this yearning for more. There is something that God has put in us, an inbuilt desire for immensity, for vastness, for transcendence. But there's a limitation to our human condition. And so we carry with us, all humans, you and I, carry an impatience with us every single day. Now, some may be more impatient than others. But the fact is that all of us have an impatience built into us, even, could we say, God-given, that we want to see more in the world. And we suspect there is more to come in the world because we want change and we want justice and we want more beauty in our lives and for our world. But we can't see it yet and we yearn for it because we hope and expect it to come. That is what Qohelet is saying has built into the human condition. And there's a reason for that. And we'll come on to that in a minute as we finish. So we, James K.A. Smith says, carry desires which outstrip our mortal frame. And this is the beautiful enigma and the tension of being human. And it's not to be lamented or regretted. This is the human condition. This is how it is, folks. Okay? And so we are not to lament or regret this void, but we should, I think, cherish the moments, the times, the seasons, if you're fortunate, where the beautiful vastness and immensity of life happens in front of us. We glimpse it, we taste it, we smell it, we experience it. It may be a kindness, it may be a conversation, it may be a song or a smell, it may be some food that we eat, it may be a piece of art, it may be even the joy of a football celebration. It may be a mountain view or a river swim. We may have all these things which are natural and physical, but they give us a sense of joy and a sense there is something more to this life, and that is transcendence, and that is vastness, and that is immensity. And it touches us in those moments. And we are to cherish those. We are to cherish those times because a lot of our condition is grappling with the voids between our sense of vastness and actually what is, which often is boredom and ordinary life, which wears us down. And at the end, as we finish, Qohelet says this, all this desire and the yearning for eternity is so that all should stand in awe of him. He's already said, and this is the Message translation, he's left us in the dark. We don't know what God is up to. Of course, as I've said already, Jesus gives a big glimpse, but perhaps more than a glimpse, but a glimpse of what is and what is to come. So we have an advantage over Qohelet. But the fact is, we are, for very often in our lives, left in the dark. And that darkness, that void, is for a purpose. That season is for a purpose, that we should stand in awe of God. There is a sense in which our human condition propels us to search for God for more of her. And Ecclesiastes 3 at the end comes to that conclusion. And that is something that I want to carry on looking at next week. And I'll just read that as we finish. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all of their toil. This is the gift of God. So how do we wear time? How do we inhabit time? We do that by knowing when we are and then how to act at and in that season. Now, I want to just show you a couple of pictures as a way of illustration to end this. You may recognise this as the Bayonne Tapestry, which is, I was just about to say, going on sale. It's not going on sale, it's going on show. For the first time in 1,000 years, who's got tickets to go and see it in September? Nobody, because they're all sold out. They sold out a long time ago. £33 to go and see it, I believe. Sorry? You see the replica for free, but it's like the 1800s, isn't it? So it's a, you know, it's old, but it's not old. Old. So this is a Bayonne Tapestry that I think the renovation's going on where it is, and it's spending 2 years in London. All sold out, but from January onwards, you can actually go and see it. This 1,000-year-old, 70-metre description picture of the events leading up to the Battle of Hastings, of course. Now, I don't do tapestry. I don't even do tap dancing. I can't even turn on a tap. I did mend a tap the other day. Just imagine that.
What, in the building, not in our flat?
Not in our flat, no. I meant in our building because I don't do things like that. So if you were to consider tapestry for a moment, and you may have heard some corny illustration from a preacher from this before, so I apologise, but I think it does have relevance. If you consider any tapestry for a moment, both the front and the back side of it, it does illustrate something about the reality of time and the sense of God's involvement in that reality of time. See, if you look on one side compared to the back side of this tapestry, the front side is smooth and clear, lines of shape and thread and colour. There is clarity there, there is shape. But on the other side, what was crisp and clear is knotty, chaotic, opaque. This is another picture of something there, the backside of this picture on the left compared to what's at the front. You can see that on the back is messy, knotty, loose ends of thread, dangling yarn. The image is very different and very obscured from what's in the front. And the stitch is an entangled, complex mess. And the back of any tapestry is essentially the times that we live in. We live in these disordered, messy times where things are opaque. We can't see clearly what is going on in our lives, in our world. We don't understand why or how. We don't understand how to inhabit those times. The world, we suspect, is something like the front side, or at least it should be. Something clearer and brighter and bolder and cleaner and more clarity to it. And yet we live on the messy, entangled, threaded, loose, opaque side. That is the place that we live. That place doesn't lack beauty. There is beauty in that place, of course, but it's just harder to see. It's harder to wonder what is going on when we live just there. When we live in that entangled mess and we can't see the full and the bigger picture. Our task in these times, to wear time and to inhabit time, is to trust God that where we spend our days on this side will not be the full picture and the story of what is to come in our lives and in our world, but what is to come in the future as well. So we live with the knowledge of one side, but living in the backside, in the entangled side, in the messy side. And we trust that God knows what he is doing for that other side to be finally and fully revealed in its beauty and its clarity. Let's pray.